throw me around again. My spirit's caving in. Pummeling. That's Chastity. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Jays were pummeled again on Wednesday. A 9-2 loss at the hand of the Astros. And it is fair to say, yeah, their spirit is caving in. After John Schneider told media that Yusei Kikuchi deserved better in that one, Kikuchi himself, through translator Yusuke Oshima, delivered the following. It's probably a difficult time for all of us, not just the position players, but myself included, going out there with mixed feelings. You just don't know what's going to happen. It's a difficult time right now. The writing has been on the wall for months for this Blue Jays team. They were given an opportunity to scrub the walls before the ink set in. They did not. This is a Toronto Blue Jays team that is now a season high 8 games below 500. They are 8 games out of a wild card spot. For as much as it matters to look at things like the Fangraphs playoff odds, they are down to a minuscule 3%. We're playing out the string here until the trade deadline. There's not really much way around it. 20 some odd games before that deadline, another 10 here before the All-Star break. And it's hard to see. Look, nothing this Blue Jays team has shown us this year suggests they're capable of a 10-game winning streak. The bullpen certainly isn't there. The offense has come around a little bit of late, but has coincided with, the bullpen doing what it's done. They still have 4 very good starters and a nice start from Yariel Rodriguez last time out. But, you know, Kevin Gausman has struggled a little bit. Poor Chris Bassitt has an ERA in the ones over his last 10 or 11 starts and hasn't been picking up a ton of wins, a lot of no decisions in there. It's a tough spot. We still have to talk about the games, obviously. There's still a game every day, whether we or the Jays like it or not. But it does feel, and those comments from Yusei Kikuchi certainly give the impression that everyone knows where this team is. Everyone knows what is going to happen between now and the trade deadline, barring something that I think we would all be caught pretty off guard by, which is this Blue Jays team finding a heater. Some Blue Jays are on a heater, though. There are some positives to build on, like George Springer back in the leadoff spot, Ernie Clement, who's going to see a lot of time moving forward. Let's talk about all that. Let's bring in Chris Black from the TV truck down at Rogers Center. What's up, man? Thanks for doing this.
It's a busy day. I'm doing a one-day, one-off in the truck. There's a lot of people getting ready to fly to Seattle today after the game. So a lot of the crew in transition, and that's when they bring in the substitute producer. So I'm raring to go today. Long drive from the cottage, but excited to. Anytime I get in this truck, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's nice for us to get we can't see much here, but we Chris LaRue was on Blair and Barker from the radio booth yesterday. Ben Shulman on Fan Pregame. We're doing what we can to integrate the stadium here. Before we talk baseball, you're not going to Seattle, are you?
No, sir. No. Nope.
Okay, so if you were though. And they're passing out like the team flies on the PJ. So you get the drink service if you want. You get the snack service if you want. You're taking Crunchy with the top pick here in terms of like Canadiana snacks.
Yeah, that came up yesterday. Yeah, absolutely. Crunchy, the most underrated chocolate bar. I didn't say it's the best, but it's the most underrated. Doesn't get nearly enough love. Crunchy bars for sure up there. I don't have it often. I don't see them often in lots of places, but yeah, Crunchy would be up near the top for me.
I don't know, man. Coffee Crisp is sitting right there in that picture from JJ Watt on his Canadian visit here. Okay, man, last night's game, it's pretty straightforward what happened. Obviously, when you only score 2 runs, there's stuff we can nitpick offensively, but the big takeaway from that one is something that is obvious if you look at the roster page and look at who those names are in the bullpen. They just don't have the arms back there right now. When the bullpen is so thoroughly hammered like that through Zach Pop, through Jose Kwas, Brandon Little did his job, but then Bowden Francis comes in. I mean, is it worth, obviously it's worth it to a little bit, but you know, as much as we could nitpick, hey, should Kwas have come in for that intentional walk? Would you have rather Little against Yordan Alvarez there, et cetera, et cetera. When the bullpen is in the shape it is, and when 3 out of the 4 relievers you turn to are bad, there's not really a lot to take from that, right?
Yeah, I don't think you can argue strategy. Like, I just don't think they have enough guys to get enough high leverage outs right now, if that makes sense. Allowing 4 base runners in 3 pitches is something I've never seen before. So that's something special. And yeah, like, it's the bullpen. But the other thing about what's happened recently is like, if you go back to, you know, the last 4 or 5 weeks, the bullpen gets the headlines for pitching poorly and, you know, earned headlines. But also outside of Bassett, there really isn't a starter pitching well either. And Fitz and, you know, and kind of in on one-offs, they've been okay. But like every other starter outside of Bassett has an ERA above 5 since June 1st. So like the bullpen has burned them, and the bullpen, when bullpens blow up, it tends to be frustrating for fans. But, you know, just overall, the pitching hasn't been good enough. And it's a shame that, you know, when Caleb Joseph and I worked together last week, one of the things he kept harping on, and it's a point well taken, was like, they just haven't had a point this season when it felt like all facets of the game were working. You know, whether it's you have the starters going and maybe the bullpen's okay, but the hitting is in the tank, which is what we saw early in the year, or the starters are going, but the bullpen's not. Now we see the hitting, you know, Springer's starting to heat up, Vladdy's heating up. The hitting's been okay for a while now, but now the pitching's letting the team down. So it's just, there hasn't been an extended stretch this year when it feels like all facets of the game have been clicking. And that's just kind of been the, you know, unfortunately, that's been kind of the pattern or the theme of the season.
And honestly, you could go back to last year, and one of my gripes later in the season was, you know, that kind of felt like the case last year. And this is not entirely true, but it really does feel like if you're going to make noise in the playoffs, if we're going to buy you out a playoff team, at some point during the regular season, you will look like the best team in baseball. It's a long season. Yep. There are like 24, 25 weeks. The Orioles had 2 weeks where they looked the best. The Yankees did. The Texas Rangers did. Right now we're looking at a stretch where it's the Houston Astros. The Mets just had one. The Phillies have had one. There's been no time. You'd have to go back to 2022 for the last time the Blue Jays went on like a real run where it's like, okay, this team's scary. This team looks like a team that's hard to play every day. You know, it's obviously you go 4-3 every week. You end up with like 89 wins and you make the playoffs. But, you know, no one's scared of a team, I think, that goes 4-3 every week. And I guess where I'm at with that is not necessarily that going 4-3 every week last year was a bad way to get to the wild card. But if you're looking at the situation the team is in right now, which is they have to get on one of those Astros, Mets, 2023 Rangers runs right now to save this from being a sell-off, they don't have it in them.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it. Like, I do, that point you made towards the end, like, I don't think there was a stretch last year where the Arizona Diamondbacks looked like the best team of the year.
Late August and early September, they erased a pretty big wild card gap to get in there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They need that run now to get back in it. And you're right, they haven't shown the ability to it. I don't think that's needed in baseball. Like, I heard JD and Ben talking in the last hour. Like, I lean obviously a little closer towards Ben, a little less strong as JD from time to time. But I don't think you need to be. You just need to get into the baseball postseason. Like, I think you're just as likely to win the World Series as a wild card team as you are if you're a 100 win team. And I think like history would back me up on that. So I really do think it's about getting into the dance, being among those top six or whatever it is in each league and every year. And so you do need the firepower helps. And to be honest, like the firepower and those like really strong stretches, they're more so insurance. They're insurance for when the inevitable injuries or bad play happen. Like, so that, you know, you bank a 10 game winning streak so that when a 2-9 stretch happens, you're still okay. Right. And the Jays just haven't had one of those extended stretches this year.
They haven't, and we can't hang it all on the bullpen. It's been the bullpen lately. There was that stretch earlier in the season where the bullpen was really, really bad, and it wasn't costing them games because the bullpen was bad when they were like down 4-1, turning it into a 7-1 game and things like that. But they are 30th in wins above replacement, 30th in fielding independent pitching, 29th in ERA, 26th in strikeout to walk ratio. They're down there in terms of swing and miss stuff as well. I know the actual stuff plus is decent, but even that would have declined. I haven't brought it up recently. That would have declined of late because they're using, you know, a bunch of guys from AAA, and you know, you can like Ryan Burr's slider, you can like Jose Quas's FedEx backstory and stuff like that, but those are guys who were available on the waiver discard pile. You know, get ready to learn Matt Festa The Mets waived him the other day. I would imagine there's a claim coming for a guy like that, or someone else is coming up from AAA today to take Kwasa's spot or something like that. Okay, let's turn to some positives here, Chris. Not for any reason other than you did some great threads on them, and it's been nice to see George Springer turn it around, and we're going to see a little bit more of Vernie Clement the next little bit with Isaiah Kiner-Falefa down. So let's start with George Springer. This is on June 23rd or June 24th. He was in the midst of the worst month of his career. We're talking, you go back to the rookie year, you go back to the lows of lows in Houston, the lows of lows last year, worst month of his career. Something clicks. He's been red hot since then. Didn't have a hit yesterday, but had a couple of walks back in the leadoff spot. Have you ever seen this quick and dramatic a turnaround? And also, I mean, you had a really great thread on it. What are you seeing within this turnaround?
Yeah, this is crazy what he's done. Like, not only June being his worst month up to the 24th, I had posted something around that time, which was like what you were referencing, but like it was, he had essentially played in 50 months in his MLB career. And by average, by OPS, by RBI, like June 2024 was shaping up to be the worst of his career. And then all of a sudden he goes on a crazy 1 week run and he's fine. Like that, the month is just, you know, average. And like, it's crazy to see, like, I'm pretty sure, I don't know the exact numbers, but like he might be like ahead of Bichette in OPS now, which again, it says as much about Bo as it does about George's hot streak. But like, he's been so, so good. And even like this stretch of the whole season up until June 24th was among the worst extended stretches of his career. What's been unlocked? It's hard to say. What I talked about in that thread was like, the bat speed was still there, even though we don't have historical bat speed stuff. Like, it was, his bat speed is still top three or four on the team. And he was still squaring up the baseball as much as anyone. It was just his results when he squared up the baseball with good bat speed was really, really bad, among the worst in the league. Now, what you need to ask yourself at that point is that bad luck? Is it, or is it something else? And I think it's partially bad luck. I think it's partially a little bit of directional stuff, like hitting a few too many barreled up or squared up baseballs to the big part of the field. And it's also a bit about launch angle. And launch is different than directional stuff. So I think he's pulled the ball a little bit more, and he's also made some swing adjustments. I talked about a batting stance change, which the guys on air have talked about. But he's made some changes, I think, to unlock some of that launch angle. I know I worked the entire homestand last week when that Boston-Cleveland homestand, and he was taking a lot of extra BP, like BP out, not just in the cage. I don't see that stuff, but like I'm talking about when we get to the ballpark before official batting practice, Springer was out there a lot, taking a lot of BP. And one of the things that seemed to be a focus, I don't know, I didn't hear any conversations, but seemed to be working out front of the plate, being more like a Justin Turner. So, and what seems to have happened in this last week is that he is living out front of the plate a little bit more, getting a little bit of that launch angle, pulling the ball more. And then essentially, since he's still got the bat speed, the results have come. Like, I don't think it's nearly that simple. But to see what he's done in this last week is really encouraging, especially when you compare it with what not only June, but the whole first, whatever, 60, 70 games of the year brought.
Yeah, and I mean, look, the fact that he's doing it against pretty good velocity, too, is super encouraging, right? Like, if you're looking for, you know, when we came into the season, hey, where are maybe some concern levels with George Springer? And I did this with Zoobs on his, or not on his podcast, but just talked to him a bunch over at the Less Than Jays podcast heading into the season. It was like, okay, well, where are the, you know, you do this with everyone. Where are the reasons for optimism? Where are the reasons for concern? And for Springer, one of the reasons for concern was, yeah, he's 34 and he really didn't hit fastballs well last year. So within that 2023 decline, you know, you obviously, it's George Springer. You come into the season, you're like, okay, if he's an average hitter, you know, that's probably the lowest expectation you'd have for a guy like Springer. But one of the things on your radar is, well, he struggled with velocity a little bit last year. And then, so that's happening this year. You mentioned the bat speed. As much as we don't have great data on it yet, we've seen the bat speed tick up each month this year too. So he's obviously been able to do something to unlock that. So for me, the ability to hit velocity is pretty good. And you mentioned there had been a little bit of misfortune within some of the batted ball stuff. I think probably not as much as John Schneider and George Springer made it seem at times. There's probably somewhere in between what fans thought and what they were saying. And then the other part of this is like the approach was always really good, right? Like he was still taking walks. His strikeout rate was down. So now you take this kind of refreshed ability to do some damage to catch up with velocity, and you add that to the process that was really strong and never changed in terms of plate discipline. There's a guy there. So with all that in mind, do you like him back in the leadoff spot versus being in one of those kind of run producing spots where he turned it around?
I think it's exactly what I would try if I were the Jays. Like, I don't think they have a classic leadoff guy outside of George. I think they moved him down out of necessity to fix some things, take the pressure off a bit. I think that was the right call, and I think putting him back up to the top was the right call. I think before this hot streak started, like, there was a lot of discussion, and there was a lot of discussion, like, within fans, media, like, what do you do with him, right? And, you know, there were people who just thought straight DFA. There were people that thought, you know, bench him immediately. And if you view it as it's not just about this year salvaging this season, but about can you make 2025 work as well? Like, I think you needed to stick with him. I think his track record and his back of the baseball card merited, you know, a longer leash in terms of seeing whether he could figure stuff out this season. It felt longer than required to fans, I'm sure. And maybe it was a tick too long. If we've learned anything from John Schneider over the last couple of years, it seems like he's going to err on the side of giving veterans the benefit of the doubt. But really, are there better options? Like, that's the other thing about this team right now. It's like, I think he's there because he's the best option right now. And I really like you mentioned, he didn't have a hit yesterday, but like that first inning walk against who was pitching last night? I forget. Blanco. That first thing walk was just a really good plate appearance. So, like, yeah, if he's that version of Springer, as you said, with plate discipline and some power, then, yeah, it opens up some things heading into next year.
It does. So my other question for you here on George Springer is you included a lot in that thread about his defense. He's been unbelievable defensively in right field this year, like pushing. I mean, it's hard to compare right field to center field, but he played right field back in his Astros days, saw some reps there last year. Have to imagine this ends up grading out as one of his best, if not his best, defensive season. When you're thinking of comparables, we don't have video necessarily, and quite, you know, the numbers are still there, and we all remember Jesse Barfield. But when you look back, like, is Rios, Alex Rios, kind of the bar for you for right field defense with this Jays team, at least of recent vintage?
Yeah, Rios could kind of do a little bit of everything, had a great arm. Bautista wasn't a great fielder, but his arm was amazing as well. Barfield was an awesome fielder. I know we don't have metrics. He, I'm sure, would grade out right near the top. But yeah, having a center fielder or former center fielder, however you want to view it, but having that type of talent to go catch the baseball in right field's a huge luxury. I still wonder, like, going forward, like, if it's, you know, in these final 2 years of his deal, and this is weird to say over a bunch of amazing highlights of him in the field, but, like, is the best value, if you told George Springer, either ahead of the 2025 or 2026 season, you know, you are a great fielder, you were a great fielder, however it is. But you know what? Like, let's DH you 100 times this year and just focus on that. If you can bulk up, just focus on hitting. Don't worry about sprint speed. Don't worry about all that stuff. I wonder what the ceiling is of his power for the last couple of years. And maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe what he does to stay in proper shape to be a really good fielder, maybe it's better doing that. But I've wondered that in the last year or so, that, you know, do they extract the most value from him as a baseball player if he's a DH most of the time for that last year or two or year and a half or whatever? So I wonder about that. But it's, again, it's a weird thing to say when his defense has been so, so strong, but it's just something I wonder about, if we can unlock even more of that power for the twilight of his career.
That's it'll be interesting to see how that goes. And he's just such a fascinating case at this point anyway. And like, he's not going to get traded, he's not one of the guys we're going to be talking about at the deadline, I don't think, like, with $48 million still owed to him. I don't think that's realistic. So he'll end up being, however this goes, tracking the rest of the season and how this sustains, how it changes, is going to be pretty fascinating to watch. We're going to get to know Ernie Clement a little bit better as a hitter these next couple weeks. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa on the IL. Leo Jimenez gets called up. It sounds like he is going to start today. He's hitting eighth and playing second base. So Ernie Clement is in there at third, hitting seventh. We're going to see more of Ernie Clement. And, it's been a small sample. He's been pretty solid. A couple of miscues defensively here and there, but he's been a solid bench piece. You had a great thread on him the other day. He is tracking to, at least in the era we have numbers for, be the most aggressive Jays hitter of all time, or like the most aggressive Jays swinger, at least. What do you see within that? What do you like about that for Ernie Clement specifically? Obviously, that's not something we'd want to apply to everyone.
Yeah, like, it's interesting. I mentioned it within that thread. Like, it's not the style of hitter I normally like. Like, I like the guys who grind at bats, generally speaking, and all that. But one of the things I kind of realized watching Kevin Biggio in a reserve role, as he went from kind of everyday player in 2019 and 2020 to kind of part-time over the last few years, is that I think, and this is just an observational thing, I think it's probably hard to have one of those pitch recognition, grind at bats, really try and have just a pinpoint eye. I think it's hard to have or implement that strategy when you're a part-time player. And I think there's value in bringing an Ernie Clement strategy in a reserve role or part-time role, however you want to frame it, like, of just being, I'm going to look for a fastball. If I see a fastball, I'm going to swing. Or if I see a hanging breaking ball, I'm going to swing. I'm just going to swing a lot. And you alluded to it. He's literally on pace to swing at over, I don't know where he is. This was a couple of days ago when I checked, but like, he's swinging at over 60% of the pitches he's seen so far this year, which is crazy. And he's hunting fastballs. This is something we saw. He got a lot of good results from it when he came late last season, had some success. I was working a series in Denver when they played the Rockies. He had some big hits that series, early count fastballs, a lot of damage. And he's just carried that over into this season and even expanded on it. He's swinging a ton of fastballs. There are some downsides to this approach when, you know, whether it's with runners on and you swing yourself into a double play on a pitcher's pitch, or, you know, first two guys get out on four or five pitches and you swing at a first pitch and end the inning really fast. There's some natural downsides, but generally speaking, it's worked for him. He's hitting at least close to 300, I think, over the last couple of years. And like I said, like, I think it's something that works well for what he's asked to do, which is come into the lineup on a semi-occasional basis and make something happen. So for that kind of setup and for those responsibilities, I like it.
Yeah, it's always interesting to look at player by player on this team, where they have some of the most selective hitters in all of baseball, in Turner, Horowitz, Schneider. Those kind of guys are right near the top in pitches per plate appearance. And then Ernie Clement, IKF, and Bo Bichette are like right at the very bottom. There's a duality to this lineup. And you're right, the swing numbers are still exactly what you said. Swinging overall 61% of the time, swinging at 76% of pitches in the zone. So a good recognition there of, he chases. He swings a lot of stuff out of the zone too, but staying on top of it, being aggressive there. Maybe it's not an everyday role because there are so many bats to cycle through third and second and left field and stuff right now. But in a larger role, any concern about that profile, or even just that he has like pretty monster platoon splits throughout his career so far?
Platoon, I'm not really concerned. Like, I don't think he's ever going to be a 120 game guy. Maybe I'd love to be proven wrong about that. I think what we see with guys like that, and even with a guy like Bichette on an everyday basis, is when you swing that much and don't get a lot of walks, and it's not a ton of power, like when your contact ability and you're spraying the ball around the field, your peaks and valleys are going to be a little more extreme, right? So you're going to run through cold. Your cold stretches are going to be a little bit colder than somebody else who takes the occasional walk, and your hot streaks will be hot when your batted balls are finding holes. So I think that's something to keep in mind with a guy like Clement. But like, it's a unique profile, right? There aren't very many guys who chase as much as he does, but also strike out as little as he does. Like, there's only maybe three or four guys who are you know, 10th percentile or lower in chase rate, but also 90th percentile or higher in strikeout rate. So like he's unique in that respect. There's a handful of guys, but like I said, it opens himself up to some extreme variance, but you know, I'll take the variance in that small sample that, you know, you take the odd hot streak, you might win you a game or two.
It's nice. It would be nice if he gets on another hot streak. Like he had one a couple weekends back, and then playing time got a little hard to come by there. Before I let you go here, Chris, teeing up tonight's game, it is Chris Bassett against Framber Valdez. But front of mind for me is not, well, I guess Chris Bassett is related to this. Yordan Alvarez has homered in three straight games. He now has the number one OPS against the Jays this season. He has the number one career OPS at Rogers Center. He has the number one career numbers against Chris Bassett. It's like, just walk Yordan Alvarez every single time up today. Like, this is like if Ryan Mountcastle and Aaron Judge like multiplied by each other when it comes to Jays killing lately.
If you ask, I'll be quick, but if you ask any of our fellow baseball media friends who I work with a lot, the Joe Siddles of the world, Caleb, Madison Shipman, the folks that I do a lot of postseason stuff with every October, they will tell you that Yordan Alvarez is probably my favorite hitter in baseball. It's not that I cheer for him. It's not that I want him to do well. It's that I enjoy watching him hit because he literally hits everything. He can hit off speed away for power. He can hit four seamers. He can hit sinkers. He can hit sliders. He can hit cutters. He hits everything. His swing might be perfect. It's as close to perfect as I've seen. He's just a lot of fun to watch. And yeah, he has owned the Blue Jays and he has owned Chris Bassett so far in his career. One thing that I've noticed when I dove in to these numbers is like the only thing that Yordan Alvarez doesn't really hit all that well in his career. And one of the things that he doesn't swing at a lot in his career are curveballs. So maybe we might see more than we would think slow curveballs to Yordan Alvarez today. And come on, that would be a lot of fun. I know the team's struggling. I know the season hasn't gone as planned, but Chris Bassett curveballs are fun to watch. Yordan Alvarez is fun to watch. So that'll be something that I'll be watching closely today.
Yeah, slow and low, I guess, to Yordan Alvarez. But man, five homers off Bassett in his career, just monster numbers. And again, three in a row here. Last one for you, I lied. I'm very, very curious. I know that your immaculate grid on Canada Day was a good one. What did we, is that like an all-time best for you? Like we had the Canadian content, the Blue Jays content, some obscure blocks in there. What'd you pull in that one?
Low. Like it was among my best. I haven't played in a long time, but then Dan Shulman tweeted about it. So I loaded it up and yeah, it's a great Canada Day inspired immaculate grid. It was around like two or three. There's a lot of like point ones and point twos. Scott Thorman, 10 home run season by a Canadian.
Wow.
I only know because he's 1982. He was my year. We played against him. He was a beast. Like we played each other in some provincials growing up. Scott Thorman, I pulled. I'm trying to think of what else. There was a lot of people used the Steve Delabar that got dropped. So yeah, that was a fun one. But Scott Thorman for a 10 home run season by a Canadian was my best pull.
Nice. That is a good one. Also, one time I played like a fairly competitive slow pitch for a couple summers, and there was a rumor that one of the teams was going to get Scott Thorman, and we were all just terrified.
Yeah, because he's around Kitchener, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like he's a Kitchener. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I forget exactly where, maybe Brantford or something like that. But we were all terrified of Scott Thorman rolling into the league. I mean, he's actually listed as Cambridge, which I should know, but that can't be right. I feel like I would have that locked in if he was a full time Cambridge guy. Anyway,
I don't remember where, like what team he played for. I thought he played for Kitchener when we played against them, but that could be wrong as well. But anyways, Scott Thorman, great pull, 0.1%, I believe it was.
And he is, he's a minor league infield coordinator for the Kansas City Royals now. So maybe I should grab him for the show and clarify all of this and see just how close he was to destroying my slow pitch team. Chris Black, have a good one, man. Thanks for making time. Enjoy the truck. Give us a quick tour. He's gone. I thought we were going to get to see. There we go. All the monitors in there and everything. For anyone who ever wondered what this looks like. There we go. Thanks, Chris.
See you later.
Chris Black at Down to Black on Twitter for all your Blue Jays threads needs. He'll be in the production truck for this game today. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to John Becker. We got Jim Bowden coming on the show a little later to talk trades and things like that. We've also got a lineup. We'll go through that. We'll go through the some of the matchup data. We'll take a look closer look at Framber Valdez, at Chris Bassett's recent hot streak. And hey, Danny Jansen's back off the PAT list. He is not in the line, or he is in the lineup. He's DHing today and hitting second. So he's back off the PAT list. Brian Servant sent back down to AAA. No other roster moves that we know of right now, but Leo Jimenez will also make his major league debut hitting eighth and playing second base. So yeah, should be a fun one this afternoon, 1 p.m. It gets going. We'll take a break. We'll talk to John Becker for Fangraphs when we come back on Jays Talk Plus is the name of the show on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays and Astros back in action. 1 o'clock today, Chris Bassett against Framber Valdez. And yeah, there are still like 75 games to get through. Even if the writing is on the wall for your Toronto Blue Jays, they'll almost certainly be sellers by the July 30th trade deadline. Let's talk to Mr. Transactions himself, John Becker at Fangraphs, see what he thinks about this Jays situation. John, before we get into that, I'm curious, how did you end up like we're all baseball fans and some of us skew towards specialties or an area of focus. You are like the transaction guy at Fangraphs. You get the spreadsheets going as a spreadsheet guy. I appreciate it. How did that end up kind of being your lane?
I wish I could tell you. It's been since I was probably 13 that this is just how I thought about things and was making lists before I knew how to use Excel and had poster board making like hand-drawn depth charts. And then from there it was just, you know, hey, no one is like super public facing and transaction wonky. So I guess let's make myself that guy. And it's worked out nicely.
Well, yeah, I enjoy it and I appreciate the work. You also obviously write at Fangraphs. And you wrote a piece the other week that was valuable for us setting up this Astros series about how the Astros had kind of completely changed their trajectory in June, got back into the playoff race here. And yeah, they're up 2-1 in this 4-game series. They've hammered the Jays a couple times here. What have you seen in this Astros turnaround? Because they're a team that, again, I've said it a couple times this week on the show. A month ago, they were in the same spot as the Jays, and everyone was like, the expectations were higher. You have so much talent. You got to turn this around. You got to win 11 out of 13 here, get back in the race. They did it. The Jays did not. What have you made of the Astros turnaround?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little inexplicable because you keep seeing all the pitchers going down for the Astros, and there are multiple times when I said to myself, okay, this is the injury that's going to be the nail in the coffin for them. And it just hasn't been. And the offense has just been so relentless. And I think I, you know, might have undersold the impact that the offense of the Astros could have, especially Jordan Alvarez has been on fire for close to a month now. Alex Bregman has finally figured things out for himself this season. And I think they're getting like just enough production from the pitching to make it work. And that back three in the bullpen of Abreu, Presley, and Hader finally all hitting their stride. And that's sort of the plan is, you know, get 5-6 okay enough innings from your starter, get it to the three monsters in the back of the bullpen. And, you know, they probably scored 7 or 9 runs anyway a lot of these games lately where it doesn't even matter that much how well the pitching does. So I've seen a very, you know, still a very top-heavy team, I think, but they're in a great position to really add depth at the deadline and make a run for the AL West crown, especially with how the Mariners are playing lately.
And the Toronto Blue Jays have not done that. They've kind of gone the other way here. And yeah, 8 games out of a playoff spot. You guys at Fangraphs have the playoff odds down to about 3%. Before we get into some of the deadline possibilities, what have you made of the Jays' inability to kind of capitalize on this core, this window that they had here over the last couple of years? You wrote, you know, their lane for contention continues to narrow. And then even if they wanted to be buyers, they don't have the depth in the farm system to make the necessary moves. How did we get here?
You know, I think it was a lot of reliance on guys at their peaks all at once. And, you know, that's what makes championship caliber teams, is everyone having their like 90th percentile season all at once. And, you know, they got a lot of those in the last few years with Guerrero's best seasons, Bichette's best seasons, Gausman last year. Barrios had a really good bounce back last year, and they could just never, you know, get over that hump in the playoffs. And now it's, well, we're on the back end of a lot of these contracts that were designed to be more fruitful on the front end, as many longer contracts are. And, you know, they're still trying to win. And I thought, you know, maybe there is a lane to win, and a lot of these guys would defy Father Time for at least another year or two. And that just hasn't been the case. And of course, the injuries in the bullpen haven't helped. And it's just a lot of guys sort of getting on the wrong end of their aging curve at the wrong time. And, you know, for as good as Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has been in the last couple of weeks, that's obviously not enough to overcome a lot of the poor performances around the rest of the roster.
It sure is not. So you wrote it in your AL deadline preview that, yeah, despite where the Jays are, that sucks for us here in Toronto. From a purely entertainment and interest standpoint, it does. They become probably the most interesting seller at the trade deadline. You wrote they have more high-end talent to trade than any other team in the league. Who and what are you looking at with this Jays team at the deadline? Obviously, you know, there are some bigger picture moves the Jays can make. Let's start with the pending free agent guys, the Kikuchi. Kikuchi, Garcia, Richards, Kiermaier, Turner, Jansen. You don't have to answer all six of those. But, you know, even in your AL preview, you know, I think three of the potential buyers were mentioned as Kikuchi destinations. Yeah. Even with a bit of a he pitched well yesterday. It had three rough starts before that. As a rental starter, Kikuchi's going to be toward the top of the starting pitching market.
Yeah, I mean, they have some of the best, if not the best, option at a lot of positions rental-wise. Kikuchi, probably the best rental left-handed starter, potentially the best left-handed starter, period, who gets traded. And it's also possible that some team sort of has eyes on doing what the Blue Jays did a couple of years ago and just letting him air it out for three innings at a time in the bullpen. And that is a very good position for the Blue Jays to be in of, you know, here's a guy who's pretty reasonably priced. He's been solid enough as a starter, has a history in the bullpen, and that puts the Blue Jays in a really good position there. Garcia would be the best rental right-handed reliever outside of Paul Sewald if the Diamondbacks decide to go that route. Richards is an excellent right-handed reliever. Jansen is really the only impact rental catcher who would be out there. And they really hold the keys, even just rentals-wise, to do really well at the deadline. I mean, we saw what they gave up for Jordan Hicks. We saw what other teams gave up for guys like Jordan Montgomery. I mean, you can get impact prospects for rentals. And just based on their recent play, it's clear that that's the market that they have to start scouring is, you know, what's the best we can do for these pending free agents.
So obviously a lot of teams need starting pitching. Who do you like for a Yusei Kikuchi landing spot? I know your AL deadline preview is out and you mentioned some possible fits. We don't need to spoil the NL one necessarily. But if you're the Jays, who are your first couple calls to on Kikuchi?
I think it's really tough to do intradivisional, but Baltimore just does make a lot of sense with all of their pitching injuries, with Kikuchi being fly ball heavy, with Kikuchi being considerably less effective against righties, really plays well into that ballpark. I think you can get a lot of deep fly balls to left field that would be home runs in the Rogers Center and are probably in front of the warning track in Baltimore. I think that, you know, the Astros, but certainly could use starting pitchers. You know, that's a little tougher fit ballpark-wise, but, you know, the Astros are certainly beggars for starting pitching, and beggars can't be choosers. As far as the NL is concerned, when that article goes up tomorrow, you'll see that there's a lot of teams clustered together. And, you know, the good thing about a guy like Kikuchi is it sort of cuts both ways, and that the Blue Jays can get someone of reasonable impact for him, but it's also not going to be so costly that a fringe team might not necessarily feel like that they're breaking the bank to maybe improve their playoff odds to, let's say, 60% instead of 55%. So I think a team like the Padres, who's been very much on the fence all year, but is in need of starting pitching, could certainly go that route. We can never count AJ Preller out for anything. And Kikuchi's always been that guy who is just so tantalizing. And I think every team feels like they can just make that tweak that really gets him going. And it hasn't happened for Seattle and now Toronto for an extended stretch of time. You know, he's rattled off 8 to 10 good starts in a row multiple times. But in terms of that one last tweak, I think that there are a lot of teams who would feel, at least from the outside, confident, like, hey, we can be the guys to make that tweak and make him into a really, really solid starter down the stretch.
On the relief pitching side, the answer to this is probably every single team. Jimmy Garcia, if he gets back healthy in time, Trevor Richards, those guys. I mean, every team is going to, if the price is right, look to add to their bullpen. So I know you'd identified the Texas Rangers as a possible Jimmy Garcia spot. Let's just say for the relievers, everyone will be interested and move to some of the more interesting names. Danny Jansen's a fascinating one for me. I've already started to look ahead to, like, you know, if they don't trade him, what does his next contract look like? The catcher free agent market is always so weird. Danny Jansen's hit like one of the best catchers in baseball for 4 years, but he's been hurt a lot. He's coming off of like one of the worst months of his career. Like, there's just a lot of noise there to figure out what the next contract would look like for Danny Jansen, and therefore what the rental price for Danny Jansen would be. Are there teams kind of on your radar of like, hey, this is a team that, whatever, forget about the next contract. You need help right now for the playoff run.
Yeah, so he reminds me a lot of how the Rangers used Mitch Garver last year and how the Mariners have used Garver this year. And that, yes, he is a good catcher and he's a better catcher than Garver, but I think you really want him for his bat just as much as his glove, which is rare for a catcher. So, you know, and especially when you consider how quickly can he learn a pitching staff basically overnight after being acquired at the deadline. The fact that he can hit way better than most catchers makes it a lot more palatable to trade for him. You know, maybe they DH him mostly for the first couple weeks while he learns the ropes, and then you go from there. I think in terms of teams that could use him, the Padres are certainly one. Kyle Higashioka's hit a lot better lately, but, you know, generally speaking, is not great with the bat, and Luis Campusano has not really done the job when he's been out there, and he's towards the bottom of the barrel defense-wise. Padres also have DH at-bats to offer, which is helpful for Jansen. Just even in terms of preventing further injury, I think would be really helpful for him to go to a team that can give him more DH time. I think that Kansas City is a weird and interesting one in that, yes, they have Salvador Perez and Freddie Fermin, but they've given Perez a lot more time at first base. DH has been something of a black hole for them. And we do see teams go for three catchers a little bit more than they used to. Houston, another one. Yes, they have Diaz and Caratini, but maybe they want to get Alvarez more run in left field, and Jansen taking on the Crawford boxes seems really tantalizing. So, you know, if I'm looking to acquire Jansen, it's not necessarily do I need a starting catcher. It's do I need a, you know, twice a week catcher who I also really would like to hit in the middle-ish of my lineup and have DH at bats for him.
So we're going to pivot off Jays a little bit here. We'll talk more Jays trade stuff over the next couple weeks. Obviously, it's all we're going to talk about pretty much. You know, I mean, look, we're going to break down Framber Valdez and how the Jays match up against him, but we're going to talk trades a lot the next couple weeks. Outside of Toronto, you had an interesting tweet yesterday, John, or the other day. So the Rays turned around, and after trading Kyle Manzardo, a top 60 prospect in all of baseball, for Aaron Civale, they turned around and traded Aaron Civale to the Brewers for Gregory Barrios, who is not even a top 20 prospect in the Brewers system. Now, look, there are things like, hey, you got to get something for Civale. If you're out of it, you save a little bit of money. You know, this Civale's one calendar year closer to free agency and all of that stuff. But your tweet was that the Rays are just not that scary to trade with anymore. And who knows? I'm sure there's still like a healthy amount of respect there. Every time the Christopher Sanchez extension came up, I was like, for Curtis Mead, eh? What do you make of that turnaround from the Rays? Turning Kyle Manzardo into Gregory Barrios, basically, with a couple months of poor Aaron Civale performance to show for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Rays are still definitely up there in terms of player evaluation and pro scouting of other teams. I mean, you know, they got Junior Caminero for almost nothing, and that was just a few years ago. So it's not as if they've completely lost it. But the idea that a single team just wins every single trade they make, you know, they've proven that recently to not be true. And really, it never was true. We just have some better examples of late. So, you know, if you want a player on the Rays, trade with the Rays and trust your own analytics and your own scouting. I mean, they are a team that is always willing to trade anyone, and they're right at 500, I think, a game over, and have a bunch of useful players. If you're a team that wants Isaac Paredes or wants Josh Lowe, you know, or wants to blow the doors down for a Taj Bradley type, there's no harm in calling the Rays. And I think the, you know, preconceived notion that you're just going to lose that trade, of course, isn't necessarily true. And the Rays have some really interesting long-term controllable players that teams would covet, and you know, 500-ish, I think a lot of teams would stand pat or buy, but the Rays have a franchise high payroll, and they're the Rays. They're always willing to trade anybody, and they have players that could really change a division or pennant race. And if you want that player, go get that player.
Yeah, the Rays are the most fantasy GM in the league. I guess AJ Preller is probably the most fantasy GM in the league, but the Rays are definitely the most out of the park baseball. Like, I'm just going to constantly tinker, turn a 44 into a 45, into a 46 over time, that kind of stuff. Okay, last one here for you before I let you go. For anyone who is a fantasy player or just interested in out of market baseball today, down in Pittsburgh, it is the start of the National, I forget the name of it, but there's a national furry convention every year.
Yes.
And it coincides with Andrew McCutchen getting red hot every year.
Yes.
He sent the starting pistol tweet out yesterday, as he always does, furries. How much are we looking for Andrew McCutchen to lock in these next couple days?
You know, I'm not a betting man, and I'm not going to be just because of FurryCon, but there is something energizing to him about that, clearly. And does him being in on the bit more and more every year make it a little tougher for him to go off? Like, I don't know. But also, like, when you've got that many eyes on you, I mean, he's a former MVP. He probably loves it. And yeah, like, I you know, am I expecting a four-homer game? No. Would I be surprised by a four-homer game? No, and it's coinciding with the 4th of July while they're at home. I think he's going to have an awesome next few days. And I'm just really glad he's back in Pittsburgh the last couple of years to be right in the middle of it.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. I don't really understand that world, but it's fun that every year we get the McCutchen tweet, especially now that he's back with the Pirates. So, lock into some Pirates baseball after the Jays game today. John Becker of Fangraphs, thanks so much for taking the time out, man.
Thanks for having me.
John Becker of Fangraphs, all your transactions needs over there. Also a twice weekly comment, a column called Top of the Order that is very transaction focused. So he and Fangraphs will be a very necessary resource the next couple of weeks for sure. So Jays are in action against the Astros today. Yes, still real baseball to play. A couple of updates for you from around the minor leagues. Yesterday, before we get you set for this game, Ricky Tiedemann threw his fourth rehab assignment yesterday. He went 3 2/3 innings, gave up a run on 3 hits, 6 strikeouts, 265 pitches. People seem to think that would probably be it for him at Dunedin. He'll be back with Buffalo sooner than later. And then, yeah, one or two good starts under his belt. He's probably on the radar for this Blue Jays team. Joey Votto didn't play yesterday, but he's coming off a pretty good couple of games there Monday and Tuesday. We went through some of the promotions yesterday as the Jays shuffle their minor league systems here. Abdiel Mendoza promoted to AAA. Ryan Jennings and Lazaro Estrada promoted to AA. Kai Peterson promoted to High A. So worth keeping an eye on that movement in the system as well. And I mentioned it a little earlier. Danny Jansen is back off the PAT list. Brian Servin back down to Buffalo. Justin Turner is still on the PAT list. Stuart Baroa up with the team for a couple days here. Congrats to Danny Jansen and his family. Pending congrats to Justin Turner and his family. We'll take a break. Jim Bowden joins us when Jays Talk Plus continues.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays back in action today, but let's look ahead to that July 30th trade deadline a little bit more here, as we will over the next couple weeks with the Jays 8 games out of a playoff spot here on July 4th. Let's go down to the U.S. on this July 4th. We're joined now by MLB insider and analyst at The Athletic, CBS Sports, SiriusXM, MLB Network Radio, everywhere else, former Major League executive Jim Bowden. Jim, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great, Blake. You know, I always love this time of year. I love the All-Star Week, and I love the trade deadline. It's always a lot of fun for baseball, and the fact that the NBA is finished, the NHL is finished, NFL hasn't started. I've always looked at it. The MLB has a little bit of a monopoly here in the month of July, and I love to embrace that.
All eyes on us, and I'm with you. I love transaction season. I love this month. I will say, though, Jim, have preferred it more the last couple years when we're talking about the Blue Jays as buyers and who they could add and where they could shore up instead of where this is probably heading, which is the Blue Jays as sellers. I know you've done a handful of pieces at The Athletic over the course of June, you know, checking in on, hey, here are the buyers, here are the sellers, here are those in-between teams. Are you pretty ready at this point to move the Blue Jays from one of those could go either way teams to this team should probably be selling?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind this team should sell. I just don't know if Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins are going to come to that same conclusion. I think if the Blue Jays continue to lose, I don't think they're going to have a choice. But they put themselves in a very precarious position by not having addressed Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette. I mean, I think that puts them really in a bind here, because it's really it's more difficult to extend to players like that when you're now just a year and 3 months away from them getting to free agency. That makes it tough. Number two, the players like to win, and it's going to be tough for them to sit there and sign an extension with only a year and 3 months to free agency, plus the fact they're on a team where right now there's not a pathway to be popping champagne in October. I don't just mean for this year. I'm talking about for the next 5 years. So I think that they put themselves in a tough spot, and I believe that their best play, without a doubt, on July 30th is to listen on every player they have with no untouchables and see what the return can get and see if they can expedite this rebuild. You know, I think the good news is you got three or four starters that you could trade that have value to contending teams. There's a lot of contenders like the Orioles that really need another starter. So you do have assets to trade, and then you got to decide on Guerrero and Bichette. Either you're going to pony up, and if you're not going to pony up, I don't think the strategy of bringing them back in the offseason with a year left of free agency is going to get you the same return you could get right now. So I think the Blue Jays have more pressure on them right now than any of the 30 teams in what they're going to do between now and the end of the month.
And Jim, you had Ross Atkins on the front office show on MLB Network Radio at the start of June. And this is when those Bo and Vlad rumors first came out, and Ross Atkins was on with you guys and said, oh, I'm kind of disappointed in that reporting. You know, it doesn't make sense for us to deal them. So you're obviously in disagreement with that to some extent. If you can't get a deal done, I believe you said it would be foolish not to shop both in a recent article. So a lot of what we're going to talk about over the next couple of weeks is going to focus on those pending free agent guys, because it's harder to get a read on the front office when it comes to Bo and Vlad and the pitchers with term. What would that look like? Let's say they are open to a Bo Bichette trade and teams come calling. What do those discussions look like? What teams would you expect to come calling on a guy like Bo Bichette?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, look, I'm not going to buy into his season this year. Bo Bichette's a really good player and a good hitter. And I know, for example, both the Yankees and Dodgers have that interest in him, sincere interest in him. Now, with the Yankees, he would play third base for them. That would be the position. With the Yankees, he would play shortstop, and they would move Mookie Betts to second base. So those are two teams that I know specifically, but there are more. And then, you know, if you're going to trade a Bo Bichette with a year and a half left, you're going to get a really strong package, in my opinion, of three to four really, you know, one top five prospect, and then three pretty good solid top 30 type prospects from that team's farm system. So he does have really good value, and the down year that he has isn't going to take much of that value off the table.
Well, that's interesting. I'm sure Jays fans would be interested to hear about that haul, especially given the state of, you know, the Dodgers farm system. Even the Yankees farm system is much stronger than Toronto's. Yes. As well. Okay, so on the Vlad front, this is maybe, you know, from here, it seemed a little less likely that a Vlad thing gets explored. You know, maybe, I still don't know what an extension looks like for Vlad, really, given how up and down the last couple years have been. Do you imagine there would be as many suitors on Vlad? And given, you know, Vlad's had a better season and shown a higher upside offensively, obviously, than Bo Bichette, but given the positional difference, how different would you expect those trade package returns to be?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think, first of all, Houston and Seattle are two teams that would definitely have interest in Vladdy. I was told the Cubs would have interest in him as well. Him getting hot really the last month would help the return for sure. I do think the return, you know, the interesting and difficult part about Guerrero is the length and dollars that he and his representatives are going to want becomes a high-risk situation because of his how you project his body to develop as he matures, right? I mean, that becomes an issue. And so with Guerrero, he's actually harder to sign now because he's the kind of player that if he wants his true value, he probably has to get the free agency to find out if there is a team that's willing to go the length that these guys want these days, right? Because everybody sees Machado's deal. Everybody sees Harper's deal. Everybody wants those 10-year deals, and the reality is a player like Guerrero is not going to get that because his body type doesn't scream anything except high risk at the back end of a deal like that. Plus, you have to factor in age and decline too. So he's a little bit more complicated. But you're going to get a strong package back for him. It's going to be it would be similar to Bichette. It really would be because you control them the same amount of time. And Guerrero is outperforming Bichette without a doubt. So you could argue that he's worth more, but then again, Bichette plays on the left side of the infield, which has value too. And someone like myself feels like Bichette will have a great second half, and I'm not worried about the first half.
Okay, so when it comes to, you know, obviously the preface here from you has been if the Jays can't work out an extension by the deadline, you have to explore these things. What do you have a sense of what extension numbers would even look like for either of these guys, or is it too kind of all over the place from afar and a year and a half here from free agency?
I mean, it's whatever the agent and the player deem they're comfortable in that range, which is completely different than what the club is going to think, which is why the extensions haven't been done. I mean, look, if you're representing players of that quality, you look at the marketplace and you're going to argue that they're worth $25 to $30 million a year and then figure out how many years that's going to be. And a lot of times a player wants 10 and the club wants to do 4. So then are you going to settle in the middle, or is the player going to say, well, if I wait a year and a half, someone's going to give me 10. And that's where it gets complicated. That's why it gets hard. That's why there's not a deal done. I mean, everybody wants to point to Toronto and say, why haven't you got this done? Well, mainly because they probably don't want to do 10 years, $285 million. And if you're a player and you're in a year and a half from free agency, don't you want to get out there and find out what your actual value is? Especially when you see all these record contracts. I mean, you look at the Xander Bogaerts contract. Who in the world thought anybody would give Bogaerts that much years and that many dollars? Well, if I'm Bichette and Guerrero, I'm going to sit there and say, well, I'm betting he is, and he got it, so why won't I get it? You know, and so that's where it gets prickly. And that's why, you know, if you're Toronto, even if you trade him, doesn't mean you can't re-sign him as a free agent a year and a half. But I think Toronto has to look at their farm system and realize how bad it is. And then you have to look and say, well, how am I going to fix this major league team if I don't have a farm system? And that's where it gets really hard. So the best way to do it is take your best assets, take Bichette and Guerrero and turn them into 7 guys. take your three starting pitchers, turn them into seven guys. Now you got 14 guys through your system, and you've quickly rebuilt. Look, you're a last place team anyway. The Tigers have a better record than you do. Like, you have to pull up the big boy pants and understand where you are, not just at the major league level, but at the minor league level. Who's coming to fix your problems? See, that's the problem. And then you have to look at Baltimore and say, not only is their major league club a 100-win team, but they have a team in the minor leagues that's better than the Blue Jays' big league team, in theory. So anyway, a lot of work to be done, and it's going to be fun to watch Mark and Ross do it.
Yeah, it'll be fun. And look, the Vlad and Bo ones are more difficult conversations because they include, you know, what does an extension look like? What about competing in 2025 and things like that? With the Jays pending free agents, it's a lot more straightforward. If they are still eight games out of the playoffs in 2 weeks from now, they're going to be talking on those kind of guys. Just how high do you think the market for a Yusei Kikuchi would be? Obviously, starting pitching is always in demand. We just saw Jack Flaherty pulled from a start because of a back issue. Aaron Civale get traded for not much return. Kikuchi obviously having a much better season, a much better two seasons than Aaron Civale. What do you think the Kikuchi market could look like?
I mean, first of all, don't ever underestimate what Tampa Bay gets in a Civale trade. They're pretty good at what they do here. With Kikuchi, you're going to get the value back of what a third and fourth starter look like. That's kind of where it's at. So if you're talking to the Orioles and you're trading to the Orioles, you're not going to get any of their top 15 guys, but you'll get someone in the prospect range of 16 to 20 with a second player in the deal. And that guy may end up being a really good player. But you've got to keep in mind, Corbin Burnes is a Cy Young Award winning ace. And they couldn't get any of the Orioles' top 10 prospects, any of them. They did okay. They got Joey Ortiz as a good player. But you're not even going to get that for Kikuchi.
That's a tough one, yeah. This is always the tough part of the deadline. And, you know, we can look back to last year and what the Jays gave up for different pieces. Corbin Burnes is a great example. You get DL Hall and Joey Ortiz. That's not a bad return, but yeah, it's Corbin Burnes who's a Cy Young top of the rotation guy, and it's obviously working out pretty well there. Elsewhere on this Jays roster, putting Bo and Vlad aside for right now, and then Kikuchi being what he is as a rental starter, who else are you most interested in if the Jays do? And this can be, you know, a rental guy or one of the starting pitchers with terms. Who are your eyes on?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, and I don't want Blue Jay fans to take it the wrong way, but this is a team filled with extra players to me. That's all this team is, outside of Guerrero and Bichette. I mean, you've got Isaiah Kiner-Falefa second on the team in hits. I mean, this guy wasn't a regular with Texas or the Yankees, right? George Springer is done. Age and decline has him. He's hitting .213. Justin Turner, it's over. I mean, he's not going to start for a contender right now. He's hitting .250 with five homers. Dalton Varsho is hitting under .200, but that shouldn't be a surprise. That's some power. I get it. Good defensive player. Okay. But, I mean, what are we talking about? David Schneider's hitting .211. Sure, he's got some homers, but where's the value? I don't want any of your guys. If I'm a contending team, I've got Bichette Guerrero, and I've got your starting pitching, and I got your bullpen. That's all I have interest in. I don't have interest in any other position player that you have. And I'm not being mean. I'm just being real. That's all I'm doing. I'm trying not to be mean at all. You just asked me a question. I'm giving an honest answer. I'm a contending team. Bichette and Guerrero are the only two position players I have any interest in.
And that's fair. I mean, look, some of those guys might still move in the, hey, you're going to be the 12th man somewhere else. But yeah, if the Jays' talent was that intriguing and guys were playing that well, they wouldn't be eight games out of the playoffs, and they wouldn't be we wouldn't be talking about selling. We'd be talking right now, Jim, about who they should add at the deadline. So let's pivot then and look at some of those teams that might want to add. There are, and again, you've been doing great work at The Athletic, kind of laying this out, the needs for the contending teams, where you see the fits. Which team on the buying side, or which teams, rather, are you most interested in over these next couple weeks? Whether that's a fringe team that we don't know yet if they're going to buy and sell, one of these contenders with a flaw, who's front of mind for you on the buyer side?
Wow, there's so many. I love the question, but I'm going to start with the Seattle Mariners. You got to go get a bat because they have the starting pitching to run the table in October. But they strike out more than any other team in baseball. They don't get on base. It's not a very good offensive team. Yes, some of their major league players like Julio Rodriguez and Ty France were drastically underachieving. Yeah, I get that. but they're short when it comes to offense. They've got to fix it. They have a farm system and the financial resources to make a move or two, but Houston's going to go right by them and wave goodbye pretty soon if they don't get a bat. So I'm really interested to see what they're going to do. First and foremost, Baltimore Orioles, they got to replace Kyle Bradish. Not to get to the playoffs, not to win the division. They got to replace Kyle Bradish to win in October. Burns and Grayson Rodriguez can go games 1 and 2, but you've lost Bradish, you've lost Means. Okay, Cole Irvin's okay, but you need another starter, and you have a farm system that's so stupid deep that there's no excuses for you not to get a starter. So which one's it going to be? So I guess those are the two.
Oh, we may have lost Jim there. We'll try to reconnect with Jim in a second and make sure we've got him. But yeah, interesting. There are just, I mean, so many teams that could buy right now. And that's part of why Major League Baseball kind of redesigned the playoff format as they did, added the extra wild cards. It is, it's designed to have more teams still in the race. So if you're looking, the Red Sox are a team that a couple of weeks ago maybe were sellers, but now they've gotten themselves right back into it. 40% playoff odds, 7 games over .500. They're looking pretty good. The Rays are probably in a situation where they should be talked about as one of those fringe, maybe they buy, maybe they sell teams, but we know the Rays, and they've already traded away Aaron Civale, and yeah, they love to do transactions. There are just a lot of teams that could talk themselves into buying. We have Jim Bowden back now. Jim, you had mentioned kind of the Mariners there and the Orioles. Same with the Orioles, the system's too good for you to not address your weaknesses there. What about this Yankees team? This Yankees team has been really, really good, and obviously injuries are a big part of why they've slid now to back of the Orioles. What is the urgency level there with this Yankees team to make sure they don't squander a really, really good Aaron Judge, Juan Soto year with a pretty good contribution from that rotation?
Well, I mean, first we start with, they're going to go to the playoffs, whether that's winning the division or getting a wild card, they're in no matter what they do. But in talking to the Yankees front office, they would like to add another bat. They were really disappointed in the lack of production they were getting from Anthony Rizzo and Gleyber Torres. So the right side of the infield has been an emphasis. They were hoping DJ LeMahieu would come back with the foot. He hasn't. He's hitting like 185 or something like that last time I looked. And then, as you mentioned, you got Stan and Rizzo also on the IL. So the bottom half of that lineup is a real problem for them. They're flexible in where they get the bat. In other words, the bat could be first base, it could be second base, it could be third base. For that matter, it could be DH, although they're expecting Stanton back for the stretch run from his injury. They do like Ben Rice, and they want to give him every opportunity to replace Rizzo there. But their main goal right now is to get a bat. And so I don't know what level bat. I don't know if we're talking a star bat or if we're talking like a Josh Bell of Miami. But that is the emphasis that the front office has told me.
All right. On the National League side, Phillies and Braves both beset by injuries similar to the Yankees, but they've banked so many games. The Phillies have banked a 9-game lead in the NL East. Their injuries seem a little shorter term. The Braves obviously down Ronald Acuna, but the Alex Anthopoulos is generally one of the most aggressive general managers in all of baseball. What do you expect from those two teams at the top of the NL East?
Yeah, so the Phillies have been all in trying to get us upgrade center field for the short and long term. And so we'll start the conversation with Lewis Robert. Now, they're not alone on Robert. The Mariners and Dodgers and Padres have all had conversations as well. But Philadelphia would like to land Robert. They think that would be the final piece that they have. I'm not sure that they're going to match up well enough for Chicago to accomplish it. They've also talked to the Miami Marlins about Jazz Chisholm. They've talked to Arizona about Jake McCarthy. And they've talked to the Nationals about Jacob Young. But outfield, in particular center field, is I think where they're looking at. They could also go get Randy Arozarena from Tampa Bay, but that would mean moving Brandon Marsh back to center. They don't love that idea defensively, but that is a backup plan for them. But that's what I'm expecting them to do. Now, in terms of Atlanta, Alex Anthopoulos has told other general managers in trade talks that, look, I hope that one of my young pitchers is going to be able to nab that fifth spot in the rotation, but he is interested in another veteran starter, perhaps a guy like Eric Fetty of the White Sox rather than a Garrett Crochet. But I'm expecting him to get a starter, and also he'll go out there and get another outfielder. Now, it might be as simple as just signing Eddie Rosario as a free agent who helped them win a World Series 3 years ago. You know, could be a minor thing, but, you know, they're not real happy with Duvall being a regular. So whether it's a platoon guy with Duvall or you know, a long-term solution in right field, I mean, for the rest of this year, because, of course, Acuna will be back. But, you know, it doesn't have to be a platoon with Duvall. It could be a guy that starts in right field. They also might make a play on Brent Rooker. So, yeah, that's Atlanta and Philadelphia where they're standing right now. The Cardinals are looking for a veteran starter. I'm expecting them to get one. They think they're going to be in the race. So that's something to watch. Milwaukee went out and got Savali. That was their big goal, was to add a veteran starter, and Matt Arnold struck early. So congrats to him. I thought that was a great move.
Okay. Last one for you as we whip around Major League Baseball here in the NL West. We always know AJ Preller is going to be looking to add if they're reasonably in the playoff race and they're four games over 500 in that mess. What about this Dodgers team? That's a Dodgers team. I know, you know, some of this was going to ride on, hey, when would Max Muncy get back? How healthy would he look? When he got back, he remains on the IL. The Mookie Betts thing, not going to take him out for the season, but obviously opens up a hole in the interim. And then they're a team that we knew coming into the season might need a little bit of extra starting pitch. And even with how good Gavin Stone and Landon Knack have been, this Dodgers team, very, very good, but never complacent. What are you looking for from this Dodgers club?
Well, the Dodgers have told me that bullpen and an outfielder is the two areas that they're kind of focusing on. That's what they tell me. But behind the scenes, I've also been told that they have had several conversations with the White Sox regarding Garrett Crochet. So, you know, what teams will tell me sometimes is different when what their actual actions are. That's why I like to cross-check and back-check that with front office executives. So, you know, look, it's the Dodgers, right? We watched how they spend their money, right? $1 billion for two players last offseason. They're out here to win a world championship. It's world championship or bust for L.A. So they definitely want an outfielder. They definitely want bullpen help. But, look, if they have a chance to get a big splash, they would do it. And if they had a chance to get Jose Barrios from you guys, they would do it. So, you know, to your point, would they add a starter? Sure, because, look, it's not a given that Clayton Kershaw is going to be able to come back and make a playoff start. He may end up coming back and pitching out of the bullpen when it's all said and done. There's no promise that Bobby Miller's shoulder is going to hold up. There's no promise that Yamamoto is going to come back and be the guy that he was to start the year. So, you know the Dodgers. They got the pedal to the metal, baby. They got all the money in the world, and they're not afraid to spend it.
Jim, with respect to that, you know, teams say one thing and then maybe in your cross-checking you find something else out. You have the front office show on MLB Network Radio where you guys get a bunch of GMs and execs on, and they're always really great interviews. How much do you find, like, when you – obviously you've been in those front office roles. You're a reporter, you're an insider, and an analyst. When you parse those interviews, how much do you walk away thinking you got something out of those GMs who come on your show, and how much of it is them kind of messaging and doing PR? Like obviously in a host role now, you have to sift through that a little differently. How valuable do you find those chats?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in my position, it's kind of touchy, right? Because I don't consider myself a reporter. I do consider myself an analyst and an insider. But I also, one of the goals that I have is I want the trust of all 30 GMs or all 30 front offices. And when they tell me things off the record, they stay off the record. I don't use it. If I was a reporter, I would have used a lot of trades that I was given a day before. And I don't do that because I want the trust. Because in my role, I feel, you know, I have a small little niche in the media, which I feel like I represent the GM. And I represent the GMs in the way of letting the fans know what's really going on. And so, you know, to have the GMs directly on the front office show is really good because it allows the GMs the medium to go directly to the fans so they can hear directly from them instead of a middleman on what they're doing, what they're not doing. And now, to your point, of course, because I was a GM and I sat in that seat and I get it. They may tell me one thing off the record before we go on the air, and they may say another thing on the air. And let's just as an example, and this isn't the case here, but I want to use the example of Bichette and Guerrero. If I were a GM, I would have done what Ross Atkins did. I would come on and I would not say I'm shopping Guerrero or Bichette. And I wouldn't say, well, I'll see how I'll play in the next month and then decide. Because that puts all the pressure on the players. It makes the clubhouse uneasy. You've affected families. It's not a good look. So you're better off supporting them and say, you know, as of today, it doesn't make sense for us to do that. We're still in this thing. We know we're not out of it yet. It doesn't make sense for us. So that's what you have to do there. Behind the scenes, you got to do your job. You're not going to keep your job. So that's. I hope I answered it. I know
you did. It was great.
Okay.
Yeah, it's helpful to hear because, I mean, I find those, I mean, they're just interesting interviews anyway, front office person to front office person. But yeah, right. I'm always fascinated because, you know, there are the aggregators and then there's, you know, those of us using a little bit more logic and trying to sift through it and knowing that it's part real conversation, part PR and stuff like that. So, Jim, keep up the great work, man. I love those interviews.
Hey, Blake, thanks for having me on. Appreciate you.
Jim Bowden of The Athletic, CBS Sports, Sirius XM, MLB Network Radio. You know where to find him. He's everywhere, especially this time of year. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got some updates for you on the injury front in the bullpen. Some of them are good. Some of them are not. We'll go through tonight's matchups, tonight's lineups. We've got some audio from Yusei Kikuchi and David and John Schneider from last night. Yeah, we'll get you set up for this 1 o'clock game and some updates around. You can also text us to 590-590. How you feeling? I have an inkling that a lot of the questions are going to be trade related and not as focused on, hey, what do you think of Leo Jimenez hitting eighth instead of ninth and things like that. So text us to 590-590. Let us know how you're doing on this July 4th. We'll take a break. Jays Talk Plus continues on the other side on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, a little Sami Zayn, Ska-inspired theme music there to get us going for this last segment. We talked to Sami Zayn the other week. As a reminder, this is that big wrestling week we were teeing up with Shawn Michaels and Sami Zayn. Tonight is the Sami Zayn and Friends comedy show at Danforth Music Hall. SmackDown is here on Friday. Sami Zayn will be in action against Chad Gable. There's a tag team title match. Bianca Belair and Jade Cargill will be in action. Jade Cargill, whose husband Brandon Phillips still owes me a makeup segment on this show, by the way, from when the Jays were playing the Reds last year. Cody Rhodes is supposed to be there. My lookalike Kevin Owens, the Bloodline, all sorts of people at SmackDown. Money in the Bank is on Saturday. There are only very limited tickets left available for Saturday. I'll be there with our pal Chris LaRue. You get two Money in the Bank ladder matches. Damian Priest against Seth Rollins for the heavyweight title, which Dan Shulman called a coin toss yesterday, and I think he's right. We'll get our pal Sami Zayn again in action defending the Intercontinental title against Bron Breakker. And then NXT Heatwave is here on Sunday as well with four NXT championship matches, including a pair of Canadians in that title main event in Ethan Page and Sean Spears. Tickets are still available at Ticketmaster. You can also search the hashtag WWE Toronto. And of course, you can watch all of that on Sportsnet Plus. Raw on Monday, NXT on Tuesday, SmackDown on Friday, all on Sportsnet 360 as well as on Sportsnet Plus, and Money in the Bank and NXT Heatwave, those premium live events on Sportsnet Plus as well. We are going to tee up this game between the Blue Jays and the Astros, the series finale. Also, just if you are a Raptors fan as well, we're not turning this into a Raptor show, but the Sasha Fezenkov saga continues to really amuse me. There's now a report out of Greece that he's officially signed with Olympiacos. There were those reports a couple weeks ago. The Raptors poured cold water on it. He'd have to negotiate a buyout, etc. But there are more reports out of Greece today that he has signed with Olympiacos. So, a little bit of Michael Grange against the Greek media here, as Danilo pointed out on Twitter. It's an amusing one. Well, I'm sure we'll get some resolution on it soon. In addition to Twitter, you can send us some texts to 590-590. And a lot of you are texting or tweeting in the same thing, that you don't trust this front office who got the team into this mess to steer through the rebuild. And I think that's a very reasonable thing. Practically, teams don't often change their front office in the middle of the season. The draft is in a week and a half. Free agency is trade deadline's a couple weeks out. It's a lot to do on the fly. You'd almost have to go with an interim candidate who knows the organization well already. Maybe it's a James Click or something like that. But yeah, I understand that intellectually it doesn't make a lot of sense that the group that got you in this mess is going to be the one to clean it up, and they may not be the one stewarding it to the next era. It's a difficult thing. It's awkward. And this is why Probably should have made that change in the offseason. Yeah. Anyway, you can text us to 590-590. Let us know what you're thinking, what you are feeling. Before we tee this game up, I want to play a couple clips from post-game last night. And I don't do that often. Part of it is because we got an empty segment here and I don't want to talk for 20 minutes straight. But there were also some interesting quotes from John Schneider and Yusei Kikuchi. Now, John Schneider's is a little more realistic, just kind of says the bullpen's got to be a little bit better. Let's hear from John Schneider and then put a bow on this game. This was John Schneider last night.
It sucks that that game kind of went that way, you know, after Yusei pitched really well. You know, starts with the ball back to Zach. You know, you gotta field it and make the play. You know, they took advantage of some mistakes, you know, whether it was hit by pitch, you know, mislocated pitches, whatever it is. I think just overall, collectively, kind of guys we've been talking about, they need to come up big and make some big pitches and get the outs.
They certainly do. And Yusei Kikuchi gave up 2 over 5 1/3, or 5 2/3 rather. Zach Pop comes in and he gets the initial out there to strand an inherited runner. But then in the seventh, yeah, you saw the clip there for those of you watching on TV. Bobbles an easy one, then gives up a double to Singleton, an Altuve RBI single that goes off of Vlad's glove. A little bit of poor luck there, but also if you field that first one, you're probably in much better shape. Then Jose Kwas enters, intentionally walks Yordan Alvarez. So that's 0 pitches and 1 base runner. Allows a 2-run single from Diaz on the first pitch. So that is 1 pitch, 2 base runners and 2 runs in. Then hits Myers, then hits Pena with the bases loaded. So grand total, 3 pitches, 1 walk, 2 hit by a pitch, 1 single, and 3 runs come in to score. He's not charged with all of those as earned runs, obviously, because they were inherited from Zach Pop, some of them. But amusing nonetheless, if it wasn't so painful. Brandon Little gets them out of it. Bowden Francis gets bled a little bit in the eighth with a couple of walks and some soft contact, but again, just didn't pitch into the zone particularly well. Gives up 3 insurance runs and then does a ninth inning there. So bit of a tough one. Not a ton of positive from that one. Kikuchi was a little better than he had been of late. And then, yeah, Yordan Alvarez continues to absolutely crush the Blue Jays to where you'll intentionally walk him with first base not even open, as the Jays did in that big inning there. He has homered 3 days in a row. Now, again, we'll continue to tee this one up, but I wanted to play a quote from Yusei Kikuchi as well, and it is through through his translator, but I read it out to start the show, but to give you an idea of where Yusei Kikuchi is at coming out of that one. And really, I think it probably gets to what we'll talk about a lot these next couple weeks, which is that this locker room knows. They know they're 8 games out. They know the trade deadline's coming up. They know some changes are going to happen. Here's Yusei Kikuchi postgame.
Yeah, obviously, it's probably a difficult time for all of us, you know, not just, yeah, the position players, but, like, yeah, myself included, you know. Going out there with mixed feelings, right? So, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. So, you know, yeah, it's just a difficult time right now.
He also said the team came in with the mentality that they were aiming to get to the World Series and win the World Series, and it's tough thinking about that. Now, all we can do is prepare and be ready every game that we're out there. Yeah, it's a bit of a downer. There was, I guess, one piece of good news yesterday, and that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is going to start the All-Star game at first base. It's his third time starting in the All-Star game, which puts him in territory with Jose Bautista, Roberto Alomar, and Joe Carter as the only Blue Jays to start 3 or more All-Star games. The most started by a Blue Jay is 4. That's shared by Roberto Alomar and Jose Bautista. Vlad now with his 4th All-Star appearance. Is now just 5 off of his dad, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Vladimir Guerrero Sr., not Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Sr. That would be, those would cancel out. Nine All-Star appearances for him. Back on the downer side was the Jordan Romano news yesterday. He went to see the Keith Meister, Dr. Keith Meister, and ended up having arthroscopic surgery to repair an elbow impingement. So he's going to be out at least 6 weeks. That would put, you know, mid-August as when he would next pick up a ball. He would obviously need to build back up. He would need to get off a mound, do a rehab assignment. So his return this season is TBD. And I think given where the team is, you can probably bet they'll be pretty safe with that, pretty cautious. Now, there's an argument to be made if he's ready, good to get him back on a mound so that, you know, game one of next season isn't his first time pitching. That'll probably come down to how Romano feels, how the rehab's going and things like that. But yeah. I think moving forward, we have to plan for as if he's not there. In today's lineup, also not there is Justin Turner. He remains on the paternity list with Stuart Burrow up to fill that spot. Danny Jansen is back. He's been reinstated from the paternity list. Brian Servin sent back down to the minors. And yeah, Leo Jimenez, who is up because IKF is on the IL with a knee sprain week to week. Leo Jimenez will make his major league debut today. I thought maybe he'd get to make his major league debut last night since it was a blowout. You've got Jimenez and Stuart Burrow. Pardon me with a hiccup. You've got Leo Jimenez and Stuart Baroa on the bench in a blowout game. I would have gotten them a plate appearance, but this isn't a video game, I guess, and there are other things to consider that maybe I don't consider. Maybe Vlad and Bo wanted to get those extra hacks in and things like that. So let's take a look at that lineup that'll play for the Blue Jays today. George Springer once again leading off. Danny Jansen will hit second as the designated hitter. He's in the midst of a pretty bad slump here. We'll see if the little break and reinsertion behind George Springer can get him going a little bit. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. hits third. Bo Bichette in the cleanup spot. Davis Schneider hitting fifth. He's been going through it as well. You go back to June 3rd, I think, is the cutoff date. He's really, really struggled since then. I dove into some of the, you know, pitch type stuff, pitch location stuff. There's nothing all that consistent. He's kind of just struggled across the board since then. Sure, he'll come out of it. The approach is still pretty solid. You know, he is chasing more over this last month, which is something to be aware of. But it's, you know, it's not as if, hey, it's just breaking balls getting him or high velocity or they're, you know, in May, at one point, pitchers were pounding him on the outside of the zone. I think trying to challenge, hey, could you get, you're pulling the ball so well, can you get around on these outside pitches? These are the ebbs and flows for a young hitter. He's followed by Alejandro Kirk in the sixth spot. Ernie Clement hitting seventh and playing third. Leo Jimenez, as mentioned, major league debut, hitting from the right side, playing second base, batting eighth. And then Kevin Kiermaier rounds it out as the lone lefty in the lineup against lefty Framber Valdez. Now, with Framber Valdez, he's an interesting one from a splits perspective because lefties have actually hit him way better this year. Last year, lefties hit him a little bit better. In 2022, righties hit him better. So it's a bit odd to go through when you see anyone with significant reverse platoon splits. Now that could be a little odd. Now you think, okay, well, the sinker, depending on the exact movement of a sinker, a lefty to righty sinker is maybe coming in at the toward the bat plane a little bit. A changeup is a good weapon for him, but that's going to be better for him against lefties than against righties. But overall, Framber Valdez is obviously quite good. So righties are going to see sinker, curveball, changeup as the three primaries. Lefties are going to see sinker, curveball, slider. He will throw an occasional four-seam to either, but he leans on that sinker a lot more. He had been dipping the fastball usage over the years, but that's back up now this year. He's throwing that sinker 56% of the time in June, and he throws it as his first pitch really, really often. Part of why he's throwing that a little bit more, I think the command on the curveball hasn't quite been there. Still gets a lot of swing and miss on the curveball, but he's only been able to throw it in the zone about 33% of the time. So that even for a swing and miss pitch, a ball, the strike pitch, that's probably outside of the zone a little too often. Framber Valdez also, and this isn't new this year, this is a long time thing, gets hit extremely hard. 98th percentile in terms of how hard guys hit the ball against him. However, 98th percentile ground ball rate. He always keeps it on the ground. So the sinker is obviously designed to get poor contact to keep that ball on the ground. The fastball, the curveball, and the changeup, he keeps all low in the zone. The slider is the one pitch he'll come up with a little bit, occasionally hangs one. He'll leave a sinker up as well sometimes, but for the most part, the sinker's pounded down the zone. In fact, Reese Olson and Corbin Burns are the only two pitchers in baseball who average a lower pitch height than Framber Valdez. So expect a lot of stuff low in the zone. Expect a lot of ground balls today. The Jays saw him back in April. He threw 7 2/3 shutout against them. Didn't walk a batter, only 6 hits, 5 strikeouts. Pretty good results. Now, overall, the Jays have seen him for 62 plate appearances, hitting under 200 with a slugging percentage under 300. Not great results. Ernie Clement's actually 3 for 8 off of him, and Bo Bichette is 4 for 13 with a home run. But Vlad's 2 for 10. George Springer's 0 for 7 with a couple walks. Alejandro Kirk's 1 for 9. Davis Schneider went hitless last time out. So we'll see how this one goes. It's not on paper the best matchup for the Jays offense, but very little is these days. On the Astros side, you're going to see Jose Altuve, Alec Bregman, Yordan Alvarez, Yainer Diaz, John Singleton, Jeremy Pena, Jonathan Lupercio, Mauricio Dubon, and Trey Cabbage. So only 4 lefties in there. They could have put a few more lefties in there if they wanted to with some of their switch guys. But 4 lefties in there, which I note because as great as Chris Bassitt has been, there are still some notable platoon splits on the season. He's given up 7 of the 8 home runs he's surrendered have been to lefties. And, you know, you would go back to last year, 21 home runs given up to lefties. So some problem there, but he's controlled that a little bit more. He's been better with that. Lefty's still with a 798 OPS against him to 577 for righties, but because he hasn't been walking anyone, because he's been handling righties so well, there hasn't been a ton of damage there lately. He actually has a 147 ERA over his last 8 starts, which is the best 8-game stretch of his career from an ERA perspective. He also has a 215 ERA over his last 11, and he's gone 67 innings in those. So averaging more than 6 innings a start over his last 11, if this doesn't tell you about the Blue Jays season. So again, last 11 starts, over 6 innings a start, 215 ERA. The Blue Jays are 5-6 in those 11 games. Bassitt hasn't taken the loss in those. He's got a lot of no decisions in there, but lets you know where the Blue Jays are. You know the deal with Bassitt at this point. He's going to throw 8 different pitches against righties. He leads heavy with the sinker cutter, and then will throw a number of different breaking balls and changeups against lefty. Again, sinker cutter, he'll go to the breaking balls. But against lefties, you know, he's been much more intentional about everything moving north-south instead of east-west. So some of those, you know, righty-to-lefty pitches, like a curveball, a slider, sweeper, that'll come into a batter, can sometimes have pretty big platoon splits. So he's tried to neutralize that a little bit with things like a curveball that goes more up-down, you know, throw multiple fastballs so they can't sit on one particular fastball, mix in, you know, a splitter that he doesn't throw a ton, but again, righty to lefty is generally a pretty good pitch. So, yeah, good luck figuring Chris Bassitt out if you're a hitter, especially when he's on as he has been lately. He saw the Astros once earlier this year, 4 1/3 inning, gave up 4 runs, 9 hits, a home run. They have seen him for 114 plate appearances total. They've hit him for a 271 average and a 514 slugging. Now, before you get too worried about those numbers, which are not that great, so much of the damage has come from Yordan Alvarez. Alvarez has not only homered in 3 straight against the Blue Jays, he now has a 1.799 OPS against the Jays this season, which is tops in baseball among any Jays opponent. He has a 1.268 career on-base plus slugging at Rogers Center, which is number one as well. He has a 1.333, not OPS, but slugging against Chris Bassitt in his career. That is the best of any hitter against Chris Bassitt. Bassitt has not allowed more than 3 home runs to any hitter in his career, except for Yordan Alvarez, who has 5 off of them. As Chris Black outlined with us a little earlier, maybe low and slow is the approach to Yordan Alvarez, who hits every kind of pitching in every location really, really well. But breakers low in the zone is one area where he looks vaguely human. He is 8-for-18 with 5 home runs career against Chris Bassitt. Alex Bregman is 8-for-23 with a home run and a bunch of walks. Jose Altuve, a mixed bag. He has gotten to him for a homer, but he's 7-for-32. So not a great track record from a contact perspective. And then everyone else in the Astros has a kind of poor small sample size results. So yeah, mixed bag there, but Chris Bassitt's been pitching much better lately than he has at any point really in his career, which is wild to say given how long and successful his career has been to date. The only other update we have for you is that Jimmy Garcia told Shai Davidi that his side session yesterday went well. He felt good this morning. So he is joining the Buffalo Bisons tomorrow. He'll pitch for them in a rehab outing on Saturday. The current thinking is that he'll need a couple of rehab outings. So Jimmy Garcia, positive news, moving in the right direction, but nothing imminent yet. We've got a few texts from you guys in the text line. One back from last week, just related to, again, I know a lot of you guys are texting or tweeting me about that you don't trust this front office to be the ones to execute the trade deadline, given they made this mess in the first place. Totally understand. Have been talking about it a bunch on the show. It's a little awkward and doesn't make doesn't logically make a ton of sense, especially if there's a job security question heading into the offseason. Rick and Markham asked last week, and I forgot to get to it, do you think a new GM would want to change the manager? Possibly. I think a new GM comes in and probably has those conversations in the offseason and things like that, gets to know the manager a little bit better, gets to find out, hey, how much of these decisions were actually John Schneider versus collective things? Are they coming down from the front office and John Schneider doesn't have full autonomy? Does John Schneider have full autonomy? We know what they tell us, but a new GM would want to figure all that stuff out for certain from the inside. Tyler from London asked, do I think the O's would be willing to part with Holiday in a package, even within the division? It's hard to imagine. Their whole strategy has been to have these waves and waves of prospects that let them be patient with guys and constantly have new guys coming up. I would imagine if like Juan Soto under a good contract was on the table, yeah, they'd probably move Jackson Holiday. given where they are. For what the Jays have to offer, it's hard to see. I don't know. I don't know how urgent they are. Jackson Holliday remains arguably the best prospect in baseball, certainly a top 10 prospect in baseball. I think it would have to be, you know, a pretty locked in superstar with some term for them to even think about moving Jackson Holliday. Brian in Toronto had asked the other day, outside of the pending free agents, who else do you see possibly moving? Honestly, this is not the sexy answer. The Bo and Vlad stuff is bigger picture organizational questions. I could see a team taking a shot on Chad Green if Chad Green pitches well here for a couple weeks. And I think that would be, even though Chad Green's under contract, potentially attractive for the Jays, just given that multi-year contract they gave him last year includes, you know, $10.5-11 million for next year. That's a lot for a guy who, you know, until multiple injuries happened, was like your seventh inning guy. Chad Green didn't have a great season last year, but once he came back from the IL, he's got a 1.37 ERA right now. He's not walking anybody. The strikeout rate's not as high as it was before, but still pretty good. And the velocity is back almost to where it was pre-surgery when he was with the Yankees. This is also a guy who's pitched in a pennant race for the Yankees, pitched in the playoffs for the Yankees. That matters to teams, that a guy has that experience, has done it in a pressure cooker situation before. So I could see teams calling on Chad Green in addition to Jimmy Garcia and Trevor Richards, who are expiring. Max in Kitchener asks, what bullpen arms are worth keeping around if the Jays decide to stay competitive? If you mean for this year, I don't know, man. Same answer, I guess. Chad Green, Jimmy Garcia. You know, Zach Pop was bad yesterday, mostly because of that error. But I think he's been, you know, 6.12 ERA probably overstates the degree to which he struggled. He's been okay. Genesis Cabrera has been better of late. But no, I don't think this is part of why they're in this issue, part of why their bullpen is 30th in the league in most bullpen stats. There's not a lot to build with here from a bullpen perspective. Some moderately interesting arms at AAA, but no one who is knocking down the door. Otherwise, they'd be here. Frank at Scarborough asks, how do I think Leo will do in the big leagues? Pretty well. I don't know. We talked to Keith Law yesterday, who thinks he could be a major league regular. He's been on our prospect radar for a while now. I've heard tremendous things for years about the defense, and the fact that he's filled out a little bit and found some strength as a hitter. You know, it looked like for a while maybe he would be like a 270 hitter with a pretty empty batting average, but he's learned to draw more walks, got some doubles power, occasional home run power. I'm really excited to see him. Brad and Markham asked, how realistic is it that Bobichet gets traded at the deadline? I don't think it's very realistic, but we talked to Jim Bowden, who thinks a couple teams with big deep pockets and big deep farm systems could be interested. And who knows, with the way things are going here, if they're very far apart on potential extension, things get even worse here, you're going to have to consider that. If the Yankees and Dodgers come call in and they have the prospect capital that they do, you have to at least listen, given where you are here. Rob from Paris says, if this becomes a true fire sale rebuild, what do you feel the fan base backlash would be, and to what extent? I don't know. I can't speak for fans as a collective or individually. I think some people would understand it, that this is a, you know, maybe they think it's a necessary thing. Hey, it's some pain now to be better down the line. There are obviously some people who will go to the ballpark no matter what in the summer because it's fun to go even for a bad team. There are some people who would probably check out a little bit. Hey, I'll swing back in when they're competitive again. I'd imagine those people, you know, 2018 to 2019, they weren't super locked in and kind of pivoted back in when the Vlad Bocor came up and they started competing again out of the pandemic. I'm not going to answer for everyone. I don't know about backlash, because again, I think some people would be actually in favor of that move, even if it means a couple years in the wilderness here. And then, yeah, there'll be some people who check out, because casual fandom is a healthy form of fandom as well. Jake in Port Perry asks, is it too optimistic to expect the Jays to be able to get a top 100 prospect or two when they sell off? Is it more likely they go for lower ceiling guys that be ready to jump in next year of hopes of competing? I think that would be the worry, that you sacrifice upside in favor of near-term guys who can help. I would understand it somewhat strategically, but the issue with the farm system right now isn't that they don't have high floor, low ceiling guys who are quick through the minors. That's what they've drafted and developed well. That's how you find Schneider, Horwitz, not Clement, I guess, because he was an outside the org fine, but Alan Roden, who's at AAA now, Josh Kasevich, who's one of the highest rising hitting prospects. Like, you've done a good job with that player type. That wouldn't be what I target in trade. I would target some more of these upside guys, particularly on the pitching side. So top 100, certainly if you were to put Bo or Vlad on the table, you would get that. For the rentals, I don't know. I guess Aaron Civale got Kyle Manzardo last year, and that was a top 60 or top 70 prospect. So it's possible. Anyway, we'll talk a lot more trade stuff tomorrow. We'll talk about it throughout the month, of course, as well. It's Chris Bassett against Framber Valdez at 1 o'clock down at Rogers Center. Hope we've sufficiently got you teed up for that one. Thank you to Chris Black, John Becker, and Jim Bowden for coming on. Thank you to Andrew Adams, Amit Mon, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blair and Barker will be back with you post-game to break this one down with Jays Talk. We will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow. We're going to sit down with Ben Nicholson-Smith in studio tomorrow for the entire hour and look at some possible trade destinations for some of these sell pieces. But first, the Jays got to play the Astros. Have a great day, everyone. We'll talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow.